Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. Our guest this hour has been here before after his journey to the North Pole. And since then, well, he goes all over the place. He just got back from the South Pole, and we'll give you a treat today, the address of a website you can go to see his pictures from the South Pole, which are just knockout beautiful. Explorer Eric Larson is our guest, and in this next year, he will be the first to complete in a year an expedition to Mount Everest, the North Pole, and the South Pole in a continuous 365-day period. He's going to be producing a documentary film, a book, an educational CD that focuses on global warming. And the purpose of the trip is to promote clean energy solutions, advocate strategies for reducing carbon emissions post-Kyoto 2012, and to collect relevant scientific data. Eric Larson is a polar explorer, a dog musher, an adventure racer, and educator who has spent the last 12 years of his life adventuring in some of the most remote and wild places left on this earth. He has traveled enough wilderness miles to circle the globe nearly 2.5 times, and he's from Minnesota. The next expedition is called Save the Poles and You Will Save the World. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. And I'm sure some of you will remember the last conversation, I sure do, that we had with Eric Larson some time ago. Hello, Eric. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you.
You're such a guy. You go hiking. I mean, you're just an amazing guy. You go all over the world doing these extraordinary things. We love the pictures from the South Pole. They are absolutely gorgeous.
Well, thank you. They aren't online yet, but hopefully I should get them online later today. So.
Oh, later today?
Yeah.
Oh, fabulous. Okay, we'll give the address later and just tell people to hold off. So now, very soon, you're going to be completing this first ever in a year expedition to Mount Everest, the North Pole and the South Pole, all in 365 days. Why are you doing this, Eric? It's quite an arduous journey, I'm sure.
Yeah, I ask myself that same question almost every day. But seriously, I think for me, what happened was when I got back from the North Pole in 2006, my partner Lonnie and Dupree and I had completed the first ever summer expedition to the North Pole. I realized that there was a lot of melting that was occurring, dramatic change that was happening to the Arctic, and not a lot of people knew about that. And while public awareness of global warming had definitely increased over the years during our planning and preparation, I still felt that it was important to connect people to these places that are so remote and really tell the story of what I call the last great frozen places left on the planet. And by doing so, engage people in a conversation that helps them know more about what they can do as individuals to help reduce carbon emissions. And that gets not only on an individual level, but also on a maybe local, regional, state, national mm-hmm. level as well.
Mm-hmm. And the trip that you took to the North Pole, we talked about that one, but you really made some groundbreaking discoveries during that trip, didn't you?
Yeah, we were collecting data for the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, and also just making a lot of observations on the state and quality of the sea ice. But one of the main things that we found is that as we traveled north and expected to find more ice, we actually found more water.
Mm-hmm. And you've been to the South Pole now recently as well.
Yeah, actually, I just got back a little over a week ago from an expedition to the South Pole. It was a little, almost 1,000 kilometers of skiing and pulling sleds from the edge of the Ronny Ice Shelf to the geographic South Pole.
Hmm. How cold was it?
You know, I think it was colder in Wisconsin during that whole trip.
No.
well, it's summer in the Antarctic, and so the conditions are relatively stable. And the coldest it probably got, just straight temperature, was maybe about 20 below.
Oh.
But which is relatively comfortable. But the
sure.
the wind chills were pretty brutal, and we were down around 50 below pretty regularly almost every day for most of the days and really couldn't keep any skin exposed at all.
Mm. And were you able to see evidence of global warming as much in the South Pole as you saw in the North Pole?
Well, in the areas that I was, no. I didn't see any sort of firsthand dramatic kind of evidence. Most of the melting that's occurring right now in Antarctica is occurring along the ice shelves where the ocean is meeting the sea ice or the ice, and then also the Palmer Peninsula. The area that I was basically all continental ice, and so while there is an effect and temperatures are warming, my small little glimpse into that environment was pretty limited.
Mm-hmm. Where do you sleep on a journey like that? How do you stay warm?
You sleep just in a tent. Every night you find a comfortable looking piece of snow and set up a tent and put your sleeping bag in and curl up and stay warm. Actually, in Antarctica, it was fairly warm conditions to sleep in the tent. Just with being sheltered from the wind, you almost get a greenhouse effect inside the tent. So it's actually pretty warm and comfortable to sleep. And basically, we're just trying to make every day is basically just trying to get in that tent to sleep, to rest up, so you have energy enough to go out and do it again.
Right. And how do you determine what is a comfortable-looking piece of snow? I wouldn't have a clue.
Well, sometimes it's easier than other times. Oftentimes we were traveling in just complete whiteout conditions and probably more severe whiteout than we had in the Arctic Ocean. In the Arctic Ocean, we were always able to see maybe a piece of pressured ice that was sticking up and a little blue or whatnot, and we could maybe aim towards that even though it was difficult to see. Yeah. In Antarctica, you're basically traveling. I mean, all we see is snow all day, and so when it's overcast and the wind picks up, we just get a complete whiteout condition where I couldn't even see the horizon line. I actually was so difficult to travel, I got seasick, and I experimented once by closing my eyes and skiing, and I was actually able to go straighter with my eyes closed than with them open.
Oh, my gosh. So how do you have any idea where you're going?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult, and what I'll do in those situations is I'll wear a compass strapped to my chest and basically just look down at the compass and follow a bearing. And so I kind of veer around a little bit. I'm not able to walk or ski as straight as I would if I'm kind of aiming towards something, but it's the best you can do in the situation.
Hmm. And I read that I wonder what kind of form this takes. You have to eat something like 6,000 to 8,000 calories a day?
Yes, yeah. We were eating on this trip, even though the temperatures are relatively warm and it's comfortable in the tent, you're still working hard enough that you start out a little lower, probably around 6,000 calories, because your body just can't consume that many calories in one day. But as you start working and your body starts wearing down, it needs more and more energy. And so, yeah, we're eating. I was probably around 6,500, maybe close to 7,000 calories a day.
In what form? How did you pack food?
Well, we try to make it as light as possible because everything that we're needing to live and survive are carrying with us. So breakfast is pretty much the same every day, which is oatmeal, but try to add extra protein and fat. And so there's some sunflower seeds, big chunk of butter, raisins, powdered milk. Lunch is kind of scattered throughout the day, and that's energy bars, Clif bars is what I like to eat. With a little bit of salami, a little bit of cheese, soup, and that's basically it. Mm-hmm. And then dinner is a freeze-dried dinner with extra fat added to it, so we usually add some olive oil to the dinner. And then we'll also bring some cookies, and actually on the South Pole trip we brought some potato chips too, which was pretty nice just to have something that was crunchy versus all that soft mush.
You have to treat yourself somehow, right, on a journey like that.
Yeah, definitely, because the rewards are few and far between, that's for sure.
Right. Well, the rewards are when you get home and you can talk about this,
yeah.
Right? Now, you start this pretty soon. Save the poles and you will save the world.
Yeah, I think the polar regions are an important part of regulating the world climate. So I think that protecting those areas is a good step towards protecting the rest of the world. And the Save the Poles expedition actually will begin next November. I think I have on my website that it'll start in May, but I retooled the schedule a little bit. So I'll beginning with an expedition to the South Pole, which will be an unsupported trip. My most recent trip to the South Pole was supported, which means that a plane flies in and drops some supplies to us as we go.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next leg will begin with a North Pole expedition in 2010. And then a little bit of a rest period, and then Everest will follow in the fall of 2010.
Mm-hmm. And Everest is on the journey for what reason?
Well, a couple reasons. One, Everest is technically considered the third pole. And so in talking about the polar regions, I think Everest is a very important place. Also in terms of how that area is being affected by global warming, it's also very important. I think the Himalayan plateau contains about, 20 or 30% of the drinking water for 40%, or excuse me, 40% of the drinking water for about 20% of the world's population.
Does it really? Isn't that
something? So it's a very critical area, and that is not often talked about, how the mountain areas of Asia or even in the United States, how ice is retreating from those places as well. So it's also very important. And then I guess lastly, from a more pragmatic perspective, Everest is something that makes the expedition more unique. And so nobody has been to all three of those places in 1 year. And so for me, for better or worse, that makes my expedition a little more unique and newsworthy, which is important basically for two reasons. One is in fundraising, but more importantly is really a platform to be able to speak about my mission.
Right. And I read, I guess, we don't focus a whole lot of attention on how global warming is affecting Mount Everest, but this was a remarkable statistic in the material that we gleaned about your expedition, that the snow and ice once stretched to Edmund Hillary's base camp, but now it ends 5 miles above?
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah, I mean, there are obviously anecdotes like that worldwide, and I'm not sure the statistic, but even like Glacier National Park, obviously those glaciers are becoming few and far between, and I don't know how many are left now, but it's not looking too good for them.
Mm-hmm. What kind of scientific data, and maybe you don't know this yet, it starts in November, but what will you be collecting, Eric?
Well, we'll be doing some similar studies that we did in the Arctic Ocean, which is just looking at ice thickness, because scientists are still pretty certain about the extent. Actually, in 2008, it was believed that the ice might even be the Arctic might be ice-free in the summertime. But scientists still are uncertain as to the thickness of the ice. So doing some more studies there just to add to that database. In Antarctica, more looking at some of the snow and particulates in snow. Again, these researchers partner with Snow and Ice Data Center. And then I'm still kind of have some conversations ongoing about some glacier work in the Himalayas, and was talking with one scientist who's really looking at some of the kind of depositions that are happening on the surface of the snow, which add to the snow melting, so particulate matters, and just trying to get a better understanding of how that's changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And how that may accelerate melting.
Hmm. Tell me how you're planning these expeditions. Are you going with many people, or just you and another explorer, or what?
Well, what I wanted to do with the expedition was bring a bunch of different perspectives into each of the journeys, and also be able to get that message out to a wider audience. And so, and also just practically looking at how we're able to travel in those different environments. And I think for the North Pole, I chose a four-person team, I think, because that's probably the most efficient way to travel and also share resources for that region, just in terms of getting across open water and all the pressured ice and being able to save energy. And so I'm working with three other people on that, a gentleman from the UK, Mark Wood, another gentleman from Canada, Darcy St. Laurent, and then a woman from Sweden as well.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember her name off the top of my head.
That's all right. We probably wouldn't know her. And you have to. I'm interested in the psychological dimension of all of this. You're counting on people sometimes to keep each other alive. So I would think that you have to make sure you have the right team. How in the world do you choose the people?
Yeah, that's actually a really important thing to me in terms of participating in the expedition, is just the dynamics that go on in the team and being able to work together to solve problems and be safe and stay alive. And so I think hard skills are also very important, but for me that personal dynamic and personality is way more important. So the first thing I do when I kind of find somebody who's interested in participating or has contacted me or whatever is send out a big questionnaire of like 50 questions. just to find out more about their personality and not so much, again, what their experience is, but what do you like on a bad day? What do you, you know, what's your favorite food? What do you like to do in your free time? How do you recharge your energy levels? All those things I feel are really important. How do you communicate? How do you like to solve problems? How do you see yourself interacting in a group? And so I think, one, just getting people to think about the type of person they are, and then two, trying to find personalities that fit well together that can be able to solve problems and be able to work together, because so much of being on an expedition is improvising. Obviously, a big part of it is planning and preparation, but there's a lot of things that happen out in the trail that you need to be able to work together as a team and execute things very quickly and effectively just to be safe.
Yeah. Sounds like you're picking cabinet positions, but maybe even with more thoroughness, right?
Yeah, or life partners, you know, I mean.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls for Eric. Our number is 800-486-8655. In 2009, this year, starting in November, he begins an unprecedented journey to the top, bottom, and roof of the world, a continuous 365-day period, and it will be expeditions to the North and South Poles and an expedition to the summit of Mount Everest. This has never been completed in one year, and only 15 people, no Americans in history, have been to all three poles. So it's quite a journey. He will be collecting relevant scientific data, will be promoting clean energy solutions on this long journey, and advocating strategies for reducing carbon emissions. We welcome your phone calls for Eric. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for your questions about how he goes about doing these expeditions and finding people to go with him, and the significance of the data that will be collected to give us a better idea of what's happening with global warming on the three poles of the world. So, lines are open, a couple of them. Grab one and off we go. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be speaking with a couple of the authors of Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. We've spoken with these authors before for their last book, and they are members of the fourth and fifth generations of a family of Lincoln scholars. This book, which is just gorgeous, is the culmination of over a century of work collecting and studying Lincoln memorabilia, which began with the author's great-grandfather back in the late 1800s. So we're going to be talking about that tomorrow during this 10 o'clock hour. Explorer Eric Larson is our guest now. He's from Minnesota as well, so he's one of our neighbors. We're talking about this expedition. He's already been on extraordinary expeditions and important expeditions, and he will be doing this trip starting in November of this year. He'll be going to, in a 365-day period, Mount Everest, the North Pole, and the South Pole, and he'll be learning a lot about impacts of global warming during the course of this remarkable journey. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Our lines are filled right now. John Treader is answering phones, and he'll get you on hold, and we'll be with you on the air shortly. Just keep the number in mind, because eventually there will be an opening for you. We start our calls with Niles from Ontario. Hi, Niles.
Hi. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. And NPR is just the greatest thing since white slice bread. My name is Niles Amundsen, and Roald Amundsen was my great-great-grandfather. And he got to the South Pole first and went to the North Pole. And my question is, how different of a expedition would Eric Larson's be than Roald's would have been?
And when did he go, Niles?
Pardon me?
When did your great-great-grandfather go?
Well, he went to the North Pole and the South Pole. He discovered the South Pole. Roald Amundsen.
No,
1911 is when he got.
It was 1911, huh? What about the those two journeys? All those almost 100 years, Eric.
Yeah, pretty incredible. Well, first of all, let me just say I am originally from Wisconsin. So even though I live in Minnesota, I still have a lot of Wisconsin pride. that said, yeah, Amundsen is one of my heroes. Pretty amazing to talk with you, Niles, just because I've read a lot about what he has done, and I think one of the reasons why he's so spectacular is because he used a lot of his, to be successful, he used a lot of native knowledge, knowledge from the Inuit who live in Arctic Canada and Greenland. His journey to Antarctica was on dog sled. And
yes.
The difference now would be that in Antarctica, due to the Antarctic Treaty, no dogs are allowed to be on the continent at all. And so for my most recent trip, we skied and pulled sleds, although that was common back then.
I see.
In Antarctica at the time, Scott, an Englishman, was also trying to get to the South Pole, and there was almost a race to get to the South Pole. But just an idea of how skilled Amundsen was at traveling the polar regions, he did that entire journey with sled dogs, and basically the only problem he had was one of his team members had a toothache. Mm-hmm. Scott, on the other hand, got to the South Pole after Amundsen and returned, and all of his team of five died 11 miles from a resupply point.
Mm.
So Amundsen was a very successful explorer and an amazing traveler and, as I said, one of my heroes.
Mm-hmm. Are you an adventurer as well, Niles?
At 60 years old, I'd like to know if the guy needs a hand.
I always need a hand.
I am an adventurer, and I would just like to jump on board. And I live in Wisconsin, so I'm used to the cold.
Sure.
I mean, when you were just speaking about the 20 below is warm, and there's a lot of folks that think we're all crazy, but it isn't bad weather.
No, they say there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothes.
Thank you, Niles, so much for calling. A great pleasure to hear from you. I would imagine that you need some kind of support to do a journey like this. Do you have sponsors for this? Are you in need of history books, or what do you need?
Basically everything. I think planning and preparing and executing an expedition requires a lot of skills, from just basic physical training to research to, you know, looking at ice conditions to technical gear things to getting sponsors. And so it requires a lot of work on many different levels, but of course, getting to these places just initially to start is very expensive, and so a big part of what I'm doing right now is fundraising. I'm actually in Colorado at a company that I work with quite a bit, Sierra Designs, to develop just new gear for these travels, and was just in Salt Lake City at a kind of an outdoor expo, getting new sponsors as well. And so a big part of what I'm doing right now is just trying to acquire sponsors to be able to pay for the expedition.
Right. And do you have a website people can go to, Eric?
Yeah, you can go to savethepoles.com.
Savethepoles.com.
And if people also, they can send me an email through that site as well.
Great. All right. Thanks, Niles, so much for calling. Mike from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hi. My question is, I missed the first part of the show. How did you grow up to be one of do what you do? I miss your background. And do you work for a university? And I just heard you answer my question about sponsors. You're out looking for them. But, yes, how did you get to this point?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder that same thing myself as well. I think for me, growing up in Wisconsin, my dad was the director of River Edge Nature Center, which is in Newburgh, just a little north of Milwaukee. And so I spent a lot of time outside and going camping with my family, and I think my interest in the outdoors just expanded from there. And I'd always been fascinated with North, and I read a lot of books about people doing canoe trips in northern Minnesota, where I live now, or the Canadian Arctic, and explorers traveling in those areas and well, and became fascinated with Arctic travel. I've always liked winter and skiing, and I think my love of wilderness and winter just naturally progressed into doing more and more expeditions. When I graduated from college, I lived in Alaska and worked as a backcountry ranger. I eventually became a dog sled guide in northern Minnesota, and I think that's when I first started doing kind of bigger expeditions in, I think, the spring of 1995. I traveled to Great Slave Lake, which is in way in Arctic Canada, the fifth largest lake in North America, and did a six-week dog sled trip there. And from there, just started doing bigger and bigger trips and always wanted to do larger expeditions.
Wow, and so you've done it on your own?
Yeah, basically.
Wow, that's great. I love that idea. My second question is, who do you report the data to when you collect it?
Well, it depends on who the scientific partners are. I'm still gathering some scientific partners for the Save the Poles expedition. In the past, I've partnered with the National Snow and Ice Data Center, University of Washington, also doing some kind of like psychology work for the University of Minnesota, just looking at human performance in extreme conditions.
And where is your base?
My base right now is in Grand Marais, Minnesota.
Great.
So northern Minnesota, about 2 hours north of Duluth, right on Lake Superior. It's a lot like the North Pole up there right now, I think.
And last question, on a 1 to 10, how dangerous do you consider these expeditions? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Thank you very
All right,
much.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, I think the expeditions can be as dangerous as you make them, and one of the ways to eliminate a lot of the danger is by planning and preparation. I will say, though, that the North Pole is probably one of the most dangerous, if not the dangerous thing I've ever done before, traveling to the North Pole, and going back doesn't really have a lot of pleasure for me in thinking about it because it is so dangerous, and that, I think, is about 10. Everest, I think, is as well can be a 10, but Everest, you can mitigate some of those factors, too, by being different things about being safe and being careful with the weather and planning and preparation. I think in terms of the three trips, the South Pole is the easiest, but things can happen so quickly. The trip I was at, traveling to the South Pole just recently, we were on the trail for 41 days, and out of my entire team, I was the only one that didn't get any frostbite, and that can just happen in a matter of minutes.
Oh. And why was the North Pole a 10?
Well, the North Pole and the Arctic Ocean is just ice that's floating on water, and it's constantly moving. And so you have these conditions that are changing with huge blocks of ice that you have to get through or sections of thin ice over just a recently refrozen lead, which is a section of open water. And then you also have to deal with polar bears who are traveling all over that place. And in our attempt in 2005, we had a polar bear jump on our tent while we were sleeping in it. So you definitely realize you're at the bottom of the food chain for sure.
Right. Justin is next from Green Bay. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to ask a gear question of you. I'm also a native of Minnesota, and I'm living in Wisconsin. I enjoy camping outdoors, and I'm wondering, when you get into the colder temperatures, what do you do to mitigate cold on your nose without running into any excessive condensation on your bag or other gear?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's two basic things that are really important about traveling in the wintertime, and people think staying warm is an issue, but really the big problem is not getting too hot and sweating. And so a really important part in mitigating moisture around your face is just not overheating, and so whether that be slowing down your pace or taking off a layer of clothes. For me, I kind of have a pretty natural progression in how I cool myself off. I'll take my parka hood and bring it down so that my head loses more heat. Sometimes I'll bring my hat above my ears, and then I'll also take my gloves off. In Antarctica, I was traveling at times with no gloves on, even though it was 50 degrees below zero, just because I was so warm. But the moisture, you're losing a lot of moisture through just respiration, and so it's very difficult to keep your face from being iced up. Some people will wear a balaclava or a neck gaiter over their face, but then breathing through that material will ice it up. I have something called a nose beak that I actually, it's a basically just a piece of material, nylon-covered fleece that I sew onto the bottom of my goggles, and that will protect my face from the wind, keep my face from getting frostbite, but also has enough airflow in there that it doesn't ice up too much, although it does at times ice up, and there'll be big icicles hanging off the bottom, but I'll just break those off.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Justin, for the call. Robert from Hillsboro. Hi.
Hi, Eric. I wanted to ask you, I have a good friend who's quite a creative educator in the public school system, and he often takes on ideas or does interesting learning opportunity. And I was wondering if you would have the ability or have done like a live correspondence to students while you're out?
Yeah, definitely. The technology that's associated with being in expeditions right now is pretty amazing, and I think it's incredible to be in the most remote place in the world, literally, and be able to check your email. it's incredible, and I think it's a good thing, too, because if you think in terms of expeditions, you know, people have been to the North Pole, people have been to the South Pole, people have been up Everest. What I'm doing, while it may be unique on one level, isn't really that extraordinary. And so I think the job of explorers in the 21st century is really more of storytellers and to tell the story of that place and connecting people to those places. And so, yeah, I do have the ability to do that. I've done that in the past with some dog sled expeditions where we've actually had live chats from, you know, the Arctic right from our tent. I'm developing an education program that goes along with the expedition, but if you have some more information or want to connect with me more about that, you can send me an email through the SaveThePoles.com website for sure. Thanks.
Thank you, Robert, for your call. Carl is next from Door County. Hi, Carl.
Hi.
Hi.
Carl, yes. My statement and question is this. Eric, your dad was the first director of the River Edge, and Draven Lee and I were collaborated in starting that and arranging for the 70-acre tract on the Milwaukee River. But my question is this. You are going to be at Rhinelander tomorrow night, and I'll be there. I was wondering if you wanted to publicize that, or were you afraid that you'll get too many people to be accommodated at the Nicolet Vo-Tech School?
Sounds like you already publicized it for me.
Hope there'll be a lot of people there.
Yeah, 7:30 at the Nicolet Theater tomorrow night, January 28th.
Yeah,
I'll be doing a presentation kind of about my Save the Poles expedition, but just a little review of what I've done in the past.
Oh.
Yes.
And my parents will be there as well. So.
Oh, they will. I haven't seen your dad for quite a few years. I think he's up at Bayfield now, isn't he?
He divides his time between Bayfield and his home in Cedarburg. So.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Oh, great.
Yes.
All right, what time is that again, Carl?
Pardon?
What time is the event?
Oh, 7:30. I think he said 7:30.
Yep.
7:30.
Yes.
Tomorrow night.
Yep. And I might mention that I'm Eric. I'm from Wabika, Ozaukee County.
Oh, sure.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
I would imagine, at least I hope, that you do a lot of those kinds of presentations all over the country.
Yeah, I've actually, for the past couple of years, that's all I've been doing, basically, is just presentations and talking about my experiences and what's happening in the Arctic and what people can do to reduce carbon emissions. And so I talk to a wide variety of audiences, from college students to businesses to K-12 schools.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy it a lot, and it's a good way to reach out to people. I think one of the benefits, at least what I see as one of the benefits, is what I do is I'm not a scientist. I'm not an activist. I'm just someone who is telling a story and is providing unique insight and kind of an interesting platform to talk about these bigger issues.
Right. Eric Larson is our guest this hour of the program. He's an explorer. We talked with him shortly after his extremely dangerous trip to the North Pole, which was in 2006. And this year, starting in November, he's going to complete the first ever expedition to the North Pole, South Pole, and Mount Everest, all in a continuous 365-day period. He'll be looking at collecting scientific data and also talking about his experiences just in terms of adventure and also in terms of the impact of carbon emissions on the three poles of the world. Our lines are open if you'd like to join us now. They've been extremely crowded. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Eric has also just returned from the South Pole. He is a person who's done some remarkable things, a 700-mile dog sled journey through northern Ontario, a six-week dog sled journey in the Barren Lands, the Canadian Arctic, several training trips to Hudson Bay, many dog sled races. He's ridden his bike across the United States. He's been a backcountry ranger in Alaska, a whitewater canoe guide in Colorado, and a wilderness trip leader in Hawaii. And in November, he starts this journey, Save the Poles, and You Will Save the World. Two more phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow during this time period, the authors of Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. This is a book that has been put together by the fourth and fifth generations of a family of Lincoln scholars. And it will also be a book that is a companion piece where you can go more after you watch the two-hour PBS special, which the Kuhnharts have also developed, which runs in February, Looking for Lincoln. All right, Explorer Eric Larson, our guest, and let's go to more phone calls. Leo from Madison is next. Hi, Leo.
Hi.
Hi.
My grandparents on my mother's side were first farmer homestead settlers up at Finland, Minnesota. And then on my father's side up at Orr, Minnesota, pioneers. And when I was young, I used to snowshoe and ski with my dad. And my question is this. When I was young, there were a lot of deer all over. Now, on North Shore, understandably, there still are. But if you went around Ely or Orr, especially around some of those areas, and around Brantwood, Wisconsin, the deer population is way down because nobody is controlling the number of timber wolves, gray wolves. We didn't make them extinct, but we set out traps and snares for them. We brought their population down, and the deer, young, survived. And there was a lot of food in the woods to live off of. In the 30s, there was no welfare. You had to get your government beef.
Okay. What have you noticed in terms of wildlife, changes in wildlife on your various journeys, Eric?
Well, I think one of the most dramatic things that I've noticed is just in terms of the Arctic Ocean is polar bear distribution. In our trip to the North Pole in 2006, we actually saw a polar bear right at the North Pole, which was pretty unusual. And we also saw, and I think the reason we did is because we had seen seals, or there were seals in the area. Actually, for most of the journey, there were seals that we would pop up from various sections of open water throughout. And so obviously the polar bears were following the food. But I think the reason the seals were there was because they were just able to find breathing holes, and so the ice was thinner. But I think that's definitely a big factor, thinning ice, and why those polar bears are moving into areas where they weren't, at least for now. However, polar bear populations, most likely polar bears will be global warming's first victim.
Hmm. Thank you, Leo, for the call. Nancy from Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I want to recommend some books. First
okay.
of all, it's The South Pole by Amundsen himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are two books by Roland Hunteford. One is The Last Place on Earth.
Yep.
And another one is Shackleton.
Yep.
Another one is Endurance by Alfred Lansing. And that contains some wonderful photographs, too. And another one is a really interesting book called Ada Blackjack.
Yes. Yeah,
and
I have
by
pretty
Jennifer
much all those
Niven,
books.
And it's the true story of survival in the Arctic. And there's some other ones, but I think those are the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of great books about the Antarctic and the Arctic, and I think I'd add another one to that list, which is Farthest North by Fridtjof Nansen, a Norwegian who did what I would consider probably one of the most amazing polar journeys in history.
Hmm. Now, are you going to do a book from this next expedition?
Yes, hopefully. I'm still trying to work on a book from the North Pole trip, which is still in the works, and I've actually been talking with National Geographic Adventure about
Great.
Writing an article for that magazine just about my South Pole expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yes, definitely write a book about the Save the Poles trip.
Oh, yes.
It's a good story, and for me, on a personal level, I really like to write. And so it's another way, again, to get that message out, too.
Mm-hmm. It's a great story. Stories don't get much better than that. The ones you have, right?
Well, I think the Arctic and Antarctic have fascinated people for a long, long time, and I think evidenced by all the different books that are out, and I think the resurgence of interest in Shackleton, and as well as how those places are changing now,
right.
and may no longer ever be the same again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Nancy, for your call. Frank from Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Frank.
Fine guest, and may I ask him if he hasn't already told us when he made his first polar Arctic polar expedition, and does he anticipate that it will be more difficult this time in that the ice is thinner and there's less of it? So was the Northwest Passage open when he went the first time, and what will he do now? So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, interesting question, and it's something I think about a lot in talking with some of the scientists who are looking at Arctic Ocean sea ice and how it's changing. Definitely a concern. I think the sea ice historically, expeditions that were going to the North Pole were having pressure ridges that were just gigantic. I mean, blocks of ice as big as semi-trucks that were heaved up in the air 40 or 50 feet. And so literally a mountain range wall of ice, and trying to get through that was nearly impossible. And so you'd have to veer around it or at times just pickaxe your way through it. What I think is, and then that would be, those ridges would be in between big flat expanses of ice. So you'd have a big pressure ridge and then flat piece of ice and then a big pressure ridge. I think the way that the ice has changed is that it's not as thick. And so what happens is you get more and more rafted and pressured ice, but those ridges aren't as big. And so you end up traveling, I think, on average a little slower because you're picking your way through much more rubbled and pressured and broken up ice. And then also, because it is thinner, it's affected by currents and tides a little more, so you're getting more leads as well. And the water, interacting with that water and trying to traverse that water, is a very dangerous proposition when it's 30 and 40 below.
Oh, I would imagine. Let's go to Sparky next. Hi, Sparky.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Eric, bravo. Bravo for you. I just tuned in. This is Sparky. I don't know if you remember me or not.
Of course.
All right. Hey, I just tuned in, so this might be a repeated question. Where could I contact, or some website that I could find out about your past adventures and your ongoing adventures? And then also, how would that same website have some information as to where you would be giving talks and lectures and that?
Yeah, definitely. So you can learn more information about my upcoming expedition at SaveThePoles.com. And there is a link on that site to my personal website, which has kind of got an overview of my previous expeditions, and that's EricLarsonExplore.com. But easiest just to go to SaveThePoles.com. Mm. And there is a schedule of my presentations and what I'm doing on there as well. However, I've been out of the country hemisphere for a couple months, so that needs a little updating.
Oh, well, good for you. This is so I'm so excited for you. This
Thank
is
you.
Wonderful. I'm glad you're doing this.
Appreciate
and I'm
it.
Sure your parents are too.
Yes.
Yes and no.
Yeah, I would imagine people were a little worried about your well-being as you go off on these extremely significant adventures.
Yeah, definitely a little bit. I think in terms of my parents, they understand that I've been hopefully understand that I've been doing this long enough that I'm going to be safe,
right,
and not take too many chances. At least that's what I hope. And that's what I try to do as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an inherent danger. I think for me, the thing is I just try not to think about it. But I do try to prepare as much as I can. I don't think I would do any of these things if I thought there was a chance that I wouldn't come back.
Right. Thank you, Sparky, very much for your call. And Ari, you mentioned email. Are there times when you are totally out of touch with the rest of the world, or are you always accessible? Is your computer working? Is your email working or not?
Yeah. Again, this is the difference between expeditions now versus the past, and that it can be a personal choice whether you want to be in contact with the rest of the world or not, just because of technology. And so I can use a satellite phone hooked up to a Palm Pilot to be able to literally check my email or send out images or whatever. And so for me, my personal choice and really is to stay connected, not so much from just my own kind of feeling better, finding out what my friends or family is doing, but more because the goal of the expedition is telling the story of that place and myself in that place and the journey and what's going on. And so, yeah, definitely very connected. The issue is, however, powering those things. And in Antarctica in the summer, and and the Arctic in the summer, it's not so bad because it's 24-hour daylight, so you're actually able to recharge all the electronic gear just by using a solar panel. Even in that extreme whiteout conditions where you can't see the outline of the disk of the sun, there's still enough ambient light to be able to charge all that.
Hmm. It must, though, if you're skiing through total whiteout conditions and getting seasick because you can't really see a horizon, you must feel like the last person on Earth and terribly disconnected during that kind of experience.
Yeah, the physical journey is difficult, but I think the emotional journey is way more taxing. And to just be so completely removed from everything else that you've always known in your entire life is difficult on a good day. And on a bad day, it's just completely overwhelming. And I go through a range of emotions on a trip that can be very hard to deal with at times. But I think in the end, I find that I also learn a little bit about myself. Mm. I also know that I'm not too different, but there are some gems that I pick up along the way as well.
I'm sure. So when you answer that question, which you ask those who may participate with you on these journeys, what are you like on a bad day? How do you answer that, Eric?
Yeah, good question. I guess as someone in charge, I don't have to answer that question. No, I'm just kidding. I think for me, a bad day is I just feel, I guess, really sad and down. I feel like I question my sense of purpose and if what I'm doing is really important. I feel a lot of times, and I don't think this is necessarily a negative emotion, but a lot of times I just feel completely insignificant. I think that's one of the things that those big spaces make you feel, that, you know, if I were to vanish off the face of the earth, this place is still going to be here and my tracks will disappear and never be remembered again. And I'm okay with that, but at times when you're wrestling with being lonely and missing friends and just being able to sit at a table, you know, all those things, it kind of compounds that feeling of helplessness as well. Mm.
But you must remember at some point during those experiences that you are doing all these things that are extremely significant. Don't you?
Yes, and that is a very important part of my having a positive attitude is my connection to other people and hopefully making a positive impact on our planet.
Right. Yeah, that's a big thing. Kim is next from Cross Plains. Hi, Kim.
Hi, I just wanted to say, first of all, my hat's off to you, and the insignificance may be because you're traveling on uncharted territory. You're leading the way for all of us to be able to say, oh, yeah, this is a path that we can follow. So, anyway, my question is the land that you said where most of the world's majority of fresh drinking water is it public or private, and is it being bought up by public or private or corporations?
Yeah, that's a good question. In terms of drinking water issues, I have to admit I'm not too well apprised on what's going on. I do know that a lot of the aquifers are becoming reduced in volume, and there are areas that are public and there are areas that are private. The thing about drinking water and aquifers and even surface drinking water is that oftentimes it covers areas that exceed political boundaries. And so I think I think that just kind of talks a little bit more about how many of these issues are, which is they just don't cover one idea. They cover a lot of different ideas, and they're often very intertwined. And that when you pull on one thing, it often is, you find that it's connected to a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm. That's a good answer. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. So what kind of training? I'm sure you have to keep in shape all the time, Eric. What kind of training are you doing now in preparation, even though you just came back from the South Pole? What are you doing to get ready for November?
Yeah, my training right now after getting back from the South Pole is just eating a lot of spaghetti and relaxing. But I've been sitting around for about a week now, and I'm getting a little antsy. I have a training trip coming up in, I think, next week. My partner for the South Pole, Hernan Macchiera, who is from Argentina but actually lives in Switzerland, is flying over to northern Minnesota, and we'll just do a week-long training trip in the area in which I live, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, which is an area of lakes connected by trails. Mm. And right now, temperatures up there are pretty cold, I think 20 or 30 below. So it's actually colder than it'll be in Antarctica. So we'll load up our sleds with a bunch of food and fuel and supplies, and then also some sandbags just to add weight and just travel and work out kind of what our systems will be, which I know obviously fairly well, but just kind of working with Hernan so that we know what our roles will be on the trip and just becoming comfortable traveling together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big thing coming up in the off season, which is the summertime. Generally what I'll do is I do a lot of general fitness, running and bicycling and body strength work, but then I'll also wear my harness and hook up a couple of truck tires and just walk around the trails and back roads of northern Minnesota.
All the best to you, Eric. You're quite a guy. And we want to remind people at SaveThePoles.com, look for your pictures from the South Pole because they are gorgeous. And we'll give you till tomorrow or later today.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share my story.
Keep in touch. Explorer Eric Larson, who is from Wisconsin and now living in Minnesota, will keep track of his expedition to the North, South Pole, and Mount Everest. Thanks to Ron. To Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production in Milwaukee, and thanks for your calls. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.